It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strangeamps. Today, science fiction, thinking the unthinkable. What is it that people like so much about science fiction?
I think science fiction readers enjoy the experience of being thrown into an environment that they don't quite understand.
Science fiction used to appeal to a select audience, readers who liked the weirdness, the science, the speculative nature of it all, and who maybe didn't care quite so much about literary style. But some of the best new science fiction is coming from writers with serious literary chops. For example, Michelle Faber's acclaimed novel, The Crimson Petal and the White, was set in Victorian London. Well, now he's turned from the past to the future. His new novel, called The Book of Strange New Things, is the story of a Christian minister who travels the cosmos as a missionary, bringing the Bible and the Word of God to aliens on another planet. But in the meantime, his wife is stuck back on Earth, where things are going downhill fast. Faber told Steve Paulson he wrote the novel against a backdrop of personal tragedy.
Michelle, you say that when you write a novel, you like to get out of your comfort zone. So for your new novel, The Book of Strange New Things, you didn't plan anything out. Don't novelists normally have an outline for how their story will unfold?
I think different novelists work in different ways, and I'm sure that the journey into the dark that I took is a journey that many other novelists have taken. It's just not a way that I had written novels before. What happened then when I had written several chapters in this manner was that my wife, Eva, got diagnosed with an incurable cancer, multiple myeloma, cancer of the bone marrow. And that is a universally fatal cancer. And we knew that she did not have long to live. She did actually live 6 years, which was not bad, given that a lot of people die within 3 months. But it was a very stressful time, obviously. And in the latter years, I was her carer. I was caring for her at home. And that meant that a novel of this kind, where the writer goes off into their sanctum sanctorum and conjures narrative out of nothing, you know, out of a completely blank space, I just found it impossible. And it looked for a long time as if this book would be a casualty of this terrible thing that befell us, and that it would never get finished. But in the end, my wife, who loved this book and worked on it a lot with me, implored me to stick at it and made me promise to write 6 lines a day, which I did. And for a long time, I wrote only 6 lines a day, which, of course, at that rate, I would never have finished the book either.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the end, I got some momentum, and the book ended up being finished in her lifetime, and she helped me with it. She was always my first reader and, in some ways, best editor.
What you're describing, then, is a book that has these two elements. I mean, you know, it's partly set on another planet, so there's this whole kind of sort of alien theme, but you're also working through your own grief. And we should say that one of the storylines in the book is this married couple who are separated by vast distances. I mean, one is on Earth and the other is off on this distant planet.
Yes. When I conceived the book, of course, I had no idea that it would end up being a kind of elegy for Eva and, you know, dealing with the loss of her and with her loss of her own body, because her cancer really brought home the vulnerability of the human body in the same way that the book deals with these issues, without wanting to utter too many spoilers here. It ended up being prophetic, if you like.
Prophetic in what way?
When I conceived the book, I didn't know that I would lose either. I knew that the book would be about loss and about valuing this marvelous gift that we are given, these bodies that we are privileged to inhabit. But I didn't know what was going to befall Eva, and I didn't know that enormous distance that is between Peter and Bea, the characters in the book, that would be echoed metaphorically in the distance that is between a healthy person and his loved one who is living on planet Cancer. I couldn't follow her there. She had already traveled there, and she was very, very far away in that sense.
Yeah. You have a wonderful description of what these aliens first looked like. When Peter first sees one, could you give us a taste of that? Could you read a passage?
I'd be happy to. Here was a face that was nothing like a face. Instead, it was a massive whitish-pink walnut kernel. Or no, even more, it resembled a placenta with two fetuses, maybe three-month-old twins, hairless and blind, nestled head to head, knee to knee. Their swollen heads constituted the oasis's clefted forehead, so to speak. Their puny ribbed backs formed his cheeks. Their spindly arms and webbed feet merged in a tangle of translucent flesh that might contain, in some form unrecognizable to him, a mouth, nose, eyes. Of course, there were no fetuses there, not really. The face was what it was, the face of an oasis, nothing else. But try as he might, Peter couldn't decode it on its own terms. He could only compare it to something he knew. He had to see it as a grotesque pair of fetuses perched on someone's shoulders, half shrouded in a cowl. Because if he didn't allow it to resemble that, he would probably always have to stare at it dumbfounded, reliving the initial shock, dizzy with the vertigo of unsupported falling, in that gut-wrenching instant before a solid comparison is found to clasp onto.
Oh, what a vivid description. You're creating an alien race that is, to some degree, unfathomable to humans.
Sure. I think one of the ways in which science fiction often works is that aliens are used as a way of shedding new light or additional insight into the way humans work. And in that sense, they are just standing in for humans of various types. I wanted to create an alien race that was truly alien in every respect.
Why did you want to explore that kind of alien?
Well, a lot of my work deals with alienation as such, the gulf between us and the other, Under the Skin, a novel of mine set in Scotland, which was recently made into a film by Jonathan Glazer, with Scarlett Johansson playing the Isserly character. That was about the way we give ourselves permission to mistreat others as soon as we label them the other. In the case of that novel, it was the alien classifying humans as a kind of animal and therefore, you know, could be treated as we treat animals. We are different species from each other. You and whoever you're in the studio with are both human beings, or I don't know if there's a number of you there. But in another way, you are very different creatures from each other, and you are inhabiting your own universe, your own planet. And I'm very mindful of that when I'm relating to other people. And of course, I'm also mindful that as a species, we're capable of mounting multi-trillion dollar invasions of other countries in which we are attempting to effect regime change or kill people that we don't approve of or whatever our agenda is supposedly is. But we do this without actually speaking the language of the people that we are supposedly helping or killing. And we actually have no idea how their minds work because we are alien from them. And on a metaphorical level, I'm always finding new ways to deal with that huge remove between us and the other in my books.
So I'm really interested in the fact that at least a couple of your novels are very explicitly science fiction. Do you consider yourself working within the science fiction tradition? I mean, are you sort of drawing on the tropes of science fiction?
Well, I'm very wary of taking the snobbish sort of serious literary novelist stance of saying, well, of course I use some of the tropes of science fiction in my work, but I would never read such material myself. And even though I don't read genre fiction anymore, I read an enormous amount of genre fiction when I was younger. And I think that one of the things that literary fiction has to learn from genre fiction is that there are certain kinds of thrills and narrative hooks and literally awesome experiences, awesome in the sense of promoting awe, that you can get from these genres like science fiction.
This is a novel of ideas, among other things. One of the things you're doing is you are exploring language. You have, to some degree, created a language that this alien race, the Oasens, speak. And in fact, it would be great to get a taste of that. Could you read us a passage that illustrates how you deal with language?
The book actually has an alien typography for the particular letters that the Oasens simply cannot pronounce because they don't have vocal cords, they don't have tongues, whatever it is that's required to make those sounds.
And so they have a hard time saying certain sounds that we use in English, for instance, S's.
Exactly. And also, of course, there are many concepts that they're not familiar with. So one of Peter's tasks is to paraphrase the Bible stories, not just in ways that avoid the S's and T's and CH sounds that the Oasens have trouble with, but also that avoid concepts that are alien to them, like sheep and lambs and by the riverside and all those things that occur in the Bible. So he has this impossible task of paraphrase, which gives the book some much-needed humor, I think, because it is a very, very sad book. I will have to try my best to say the unsayable
right.
When I read this passage. Granger, stiff with unease, walked to the rear of the vehicle to stow the tub back in the trunk. As soon as her back was turned, the Oasen sidled up to Peter, bringing them face to face.
"Have you the book?"
"The book?"
"The book of strange new things."
Peter blinked and tried to breathe normally. Up close, the Oasen's flesh smelled sweet, not the sweet of rot, but sweet like fresh fruit. "You mean the Bible?" he said.
"We speak never the name. Power of the book forbid. Flame give warmth."
With outstretched hands, he mimed the action of warming oneself on a fire, getting too close and being burned. "But you mean the word of God," said Peter. "The gospel."
"The gospel. The technique of Jesus."
Peter nodded, but it was a moment before he decoded the last word from its impeded passage through the Oasen's head cleft. "Jesus," he echoed in wonder. The Oasen reached out one hand and, with an unmistakably tender motion, stroked Peter's cheek with the tip of a glove.
"We pray Jesus for your coming," he said.
That's Michelle Faber reading from his novel, The Book of Strange New Things. Faber says it'll be his last novel. I guess we can always hope he changes his mind. Now, there's another writer you may not have heard of if you don't read science fiction magazines, Ted Chiang. He doesn't write a lot. So far, he's published about 14 short stories or novellas. But pretty much everything he's written has won one of the very top science fiction or fantasy awards. Chiang's one of those writers who puts the science in science fiction, but in a humanistic way. He's written stories inspired by Fermat's Last Theorem and by the nature of time. He's imagined alien languages and non-linear memory recollection. Steve Paulson sat down with him to talk about his short story collection, Stories of Your Life and Others.
Ted, I'm really curious about how you construct your stories because it's really fascinating. I mean, it's sort of like you establish a premise that you want to explore, some kind of futuristic thing that might happen, and then, you know, you sort of break it down and look at the consequences. And I'm thinking about, for instance, one of your most famous short stories, Story of Your Life. Can you tell me about the premise of the story and where the idea came from?
It's about a linguist who is assigned to decipher an alien language. And in the course of learning this alien language, she finds that it reshapes her mode of thinking. And one of the consequences of that is that she is able to see the future She can't change the future, but she's able to know what will happen.
When you're talking about alien language, I mean, you're talking about a language from an alien intelligent species from somewhere else in the universe. I mean,
yes.
This is essentially a first contact story. You know, how do you communicate with an intelligent alien species?
Yes, it is an extraterrestrial alien language
right. That
she is having to learn.
So what was it about this idea of language that so fascinated you?
Actually, the story did not originate with the question of language. It actually originated with this principle of physics, the variational principle of physics. Maybe more significantly, the story began with the idea of knowing the future but not being able to do anything about it, knowing that both good things and bad things would happen to you, and how that would affect you having this foreknowledge.
Your protagonist is this linguist named Louise Banks, and she is enlisted by the military to learn two distinct forms of language from this race of aliens called the heptapods. Can you tell me about these two different kinds of alien languages?
The aliens, they use both a spoken language and a written language. And one of the things that I wanted to explore was the idea of a written language that was not a representation of speech. All human writing is a representation of speech. Written Chinese is a representation of speech. Egyptian hieroglyphics is a representation of speech. Mayan glyphs are a representation of speech. So I was interested in the idea of a writing system which did not represent speech but was able to convey everything that language could convey. And so the aliens in the story, their spoken language and their written language are essentially unrelated. And so the characters refer to their spoken language as heptapod A, and they refer to their written language as heptapod B.
Hmm. Actually, I'd love to get a taste of the story. Could you read a passage?
Sure. More interesting was the fact that heptapod B was changing the way that I thought. For me, thinking typically meant speaking in an internal voice. As we say in the trade, my thoughts were phonologically coded. My internal voice normally spoke in English, but that wasn't a requirement. The summer after my senior year in high school, I attended a total immersion program for learning Russian. By the end of the summer, I was thinking and even dreaming in Russian. But it was always spoken Russian. Different language, same mode. A voice speaking silently aloud. The idea of thinking in a linguistic yet non-phonological mode always intrigued me. I had a friend born of deaf parents. He grew up using American Sign Language, and he told me that he often thought in ASL instead of English. I used to wonder what it was like to have one's thoughts be manually coded, to reason using an inner pair of hands instead of an inner voice. With heptapod B, I was experiencing something just as foreign. My thoughts were becoming graphically coded. There were trance-like moments during the day when my thoughts weren't expressed with my internal voice. Instead, I saw semigrams with my mind's eye, sprouting like frost on a windowpane. As I grew more fluent, semigraphic designs would appear fully formed, articulating even complex ideas all at once. My thought processes weren't moving any faster as a result, though. Instead of racing forward, my mind hung balanced on the symmetry underlying the semigrams. The semigrams seemed to be something more than language. They were almost like mandalas. I found myself in a meditative state, contemplating the way in which premises and conclusions were interchangeable. There was no direction inherent in the way propositions were connected, no train of thought moving along a particular route. All the components in an act of reasoning were equally powerful, all having identical precedence.
Oh, that is wonderful and so evocative. I mean, the idea that you're playing with in the story is that when this linguist learns this alien language, she actually... Oh, it's almost as if her mind is rewired. She comes to think in a totally different way.
Yes, that's an idea that has always fascinated me, the idea that language shapes the way we think. Linguists refer to this as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. The strong form of the hypothesis has largely been discredited because it appears that it is possible to translate from any language into any other language. So language does not completely constrain or control the types of thoughts one can have. But it is a notion that I continue to find fascinating, just the way that language shapes our thoughts.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask about another one of your stories, Hell is the Absence of God, which I have to say reads almost more like a horror story than a science fiction story. First of all, can you tell us what the basic idea of this story is?
The story is set in a world in which God's existence is a given. Everyone knows that God exists because angels regularly make appearances, and angelic visitations are sort of akin to natural disasters. Because of the types of beings that angels are, their visitations have the impact of, say, a tornado or an earthquake.
These are not fuzzy, kind angels. I mean, this is sort of a harsher view of the angelic world.
This is sort of in keeping with certain lines in the Old Testament about how the appearance of angels caused strong men to fall to the ground in terror because they're beings from another dimension, and it is hard for our mortal senses to look upon them. It is actively painful for us.
Well, tell me about the main character in this story, Hell is the Absence of God. It's a guy named Neil Fisk. How would you describe him?
Neil is a man who hasn't had it easy in life. He was born with a birth defect, and many people believe that this is a judgment on him. It was not. It was simply an ordinary birth defect. But in a world in which a lot of terrible things can be directly attributed to God, things like birth defects will be interpreted as being a judgment of God, even if they aren't.
And then his wife is struck down, is killed by one of these angelic visitations.
Yes. Neil's wife is killed during an angelic visitation, and her soul is seen ascending into heaven. And this puts Neil in a difficult position because his only chance to be reunited with his wife in the afterlife is if he can sincerely love God so that he will go to heaven when he dies. But he is very angry at God because one of God's angels killed his wife. And so he is struggling to reconcile these two things, the fact that he blames God for the death of his wife, but he has to love God if he is going to have any chance of being reunited with her.
Right. Could you read a passage from this story?
Sure. In public, Neil was able to mask his grief as adults are expected to. But in the privacy of his apartment, the floodgates of emotion burst open. The awareness of Sarah's absence would overwhelm him, and then he'd collapse on the floor and weep. He'd curl up into a ball, his body racked by hiccuping sobs, tears and mucus streaming down his face, the anguish coming in ever-increasing waves, until it was more than he could bear, more intense than he'd have believed possible. Minutes or hours later, it would leave, and he would fall asleep, exhausted. And the next morning, he would wake up and face the prospect of another day without Sarah. An elderly woman in Neil's apartment building tried to comfort him by telling him that the pain would lessen in time, and while he would never forget his wife, he would at least be able to move on. Then he would meet someone else one day and find happiness with her, and he would learn to love God and thus ascend to heaven when his time came. The woman's intentions were good, but Neil was in no position to find any comfort in her words. Sarah's absence felt like an open wound, and the prospect that someday he would no longer feel pain at her loss seemed not just remote, but a physical impossibility. If suicide would have ended his pain, he'd have done it without hesitation, but that would only ensure that his separation from Sarah was permanent.
That's Ted Chiang, reading from his short story, Hell is the Absence of God. It's from his collection, Stories of Your Life and Others. He talked with Steve Paulson. Science fiction has been called the last great literature of ideas. Coming up, we'll talk with science fiction writer Eileen Gunn about her latest thought experiments. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. There's a classic science fiction story called Stable Strategies for Middle Management. It's about an ad executive in a big corporation. Her name is Margaret. To prove her loyalty to the company, she undergoes bioengineering, the goal of which is to transform her into a giant insect. The story begins as she wakes up one morning to find that her tongue has changed into a stiletto and that she has a strange new craving to suck her colleagues' blood and encase her friends in wax. The story is a play on Kafka's Metamorphosis, but set in a giant American corporation. And the story's author, Eileen Gunn, was once an ad executive herself for the giant called Microsoft. Her latest collection of stories is titled Questionable Practices, and Doug Gordon caught up with her.
Eileen, your short stories are often described as thought experiments. And earlier this year, Charlie Jane Anders wrote on the science fiction blog IO9 that plenty of science fiction and fantasy authors do thought experiments, but few of them disregard experimental safety protocols with quite as much gleeful abandon as Eileen Gunn. What do you think of that description?
Oh, I love it. I think that describing my story as this thought experience, I think she was leaping off of the story entitled Thought Experiment. Fiction is a thought experiment in that sense. Everything that you do when you sit down to write a story is an experimental way of plotting a life or a moment, you know, depending on the length and the plot. It's all thought experiments. I think some people took objection to my stories being characterized as thought experiments. I'm not as bound by definitions as sometimes other people are. I don't think I fit into any one category. There are a lot of people, especially in science fiction, who like categories. Categories give you a way of sorting the universe. I mean, in a way, categories are thought experiments.
But they're also stifling, though, aren't they? They can stifle the creativity, and then because if you have all these categories, then with the categories come certain expectations on the part of the reader and often on the part of the writer as well.
If the writer accepts them, basically you don't have to accept anybody's idea of what you're doing. Young writers are often told that if they do this and they do that, they will be successful. But that's not actually true. You can't follow a pattern and have that make you automatically successful.
Yeah. Your new collection, Questionable Practices, features a story called Thought Experiment. The opening scene of this story finds your protagonist, Ralph Drum Jr., visiting the dentist. And I'd like to have you read an excerpt from this opening.
Okay. So that Ralph is in the dentist chair. And he's having his teeth whitened, which he has never had done before. The whitening process took an hour and a half, and it was not as much fun as the advertising brochure promised. But Ralph had a great fondness for thought experiments, so he set his mind to figuring out how to disassociate himself from the dentist chair. Being an engineer, he thought it through in a very logical and orderly way. It was Ralph's genius to intuit that time travel is accomplished entirely in your head. You just need some basic software development skills, plus powers of concentration that work in all four dimensions. It seemed simple enough, merely a matter of disassociating not only his mind, but also his body. A trick, a mere bagatelle, involving a sort of n-dimensional mental toolbar that controls the user's time shadow. The body stays behind where it started, and the time shadow travels freely until it alights in another time and place, where it generates a copy of the original world line, body and all, in the time stream. Ralph wondered why nobody had ever thought of it before. He was about to test it when the hygienist came back and started hosing out the inside of his mouth. Better leave this until I get home, Ralph thought. Even if it didn't work, it was a wonderful theory, and it certainly whiled away 90 minutes that would otherwise have been entirely wasted intellectually.
Wonderful. That was great. Thank you. One of the most powerful stories in questionable practices is called Chop Wood, Carry Water. Can you tell me a bit about this story?
I had been in Prague, and when I came back, I got an email from Michael Swanwick saying, quick, act without thinking. Write a story about the golem from the golem's point of view. As usual, I thought, golem is a trope. It's been overdone. So my immediate reaction was, well, somebody's already done that. Why would I do that? And I put the idea down, and then I started thinking about it. And thought, well, just what did they do when they did that? So I searched, and I read golem stories, and nobody did represent the golem's point of view. I actually overlooked a novel, He, She, and It, by Marge Percy, where she did have a golem in the story. It's a science fiction story. A section was written from the golem's point of view. But that's not how traditional stories went, and the golem stories are all modeled on traditional folk tales. So I thought, well, okay, then it wouldn't be completely unoriginal if I did that. And I just started writing it from the golem's point of view, and the golem came in and took over.
Could I have you read the first page of Chop Wood, Carry Water?
Sure. They say you can't remember before you were born, but I remember. I was cold, cold and damp and clammy. I wanted nothing. I did not know hunger, thirst, or desire. I lived in the dark, and I didn't have a thought in my head. I was free. Then, of course, things changed. I awoke from a dreamless sleep to the dreadful noise of three black-clad men bowing and chanting psalms, to the stench of burning metal and baking clay, and to the pall of steam hanging over it all on the muddy bank of the Vltava. I was torn from my bed. I was granted this half-life and became subject to the will of the rabbi. The rabbi was not a bad man. Things could have been much worse. He was a compassionate and contemplative human being, interested in dispelling those mysteries that are man's to dispel. Moral issues were important to him, and he seemed to consider worthy even the life in golems. But I lost, in that instant of formation, my merciful shapelessness, my oneness with the universe. Yet I did not gain the one thing that would have, I am told, been recompense for those losses. I must tell you now that, in my opinion, souls are overrated. Compared to the deep, volitionless comfort that comes from being truly a part of the earth, humans and their souls never know a day of rest. They hunger, they thirst, they long for one another in ways that I am not equipped to understand. They lack deep peace, and a soul seems poor compensation for this absence.
That was great, and it's a very poignant and very powerful story. As you say, the golem really took over. He's yearning to return to his original state of inanimate clay. Just a really great, powerful piece of writing. Back in 1986, your fellow writer, William Gibson, told you the secret of writing. What did he say?
I had run into him at a convention. He came down the hallway towards me and saw me and came over and said, I've just discovered the secret of writing. We have to talk. So we went into the bar and we're talking about our families and whatever. Bill was the guest of honor, and pretty soon the convention organizer came up and said, you're on, dragged him away. The way conventions go, I never really saw much of him after that for the rest of the weekend. And 2 weeks later, I'm at home writing, trying to write, and I get a phone call from Bill. I pick up the phone. He says, I forgot to tell you the secret of writing. Kind of a pause, and he cleared his throat. He said, you must learn to overcome your very natural and appropriate revulsion to your own work. And I thought about that, and you think, if that is William Gibson's secret of writing, what right do I have to be moody about the quality of my work?
So I have to ask you, Have you managed to overcome your very natural and appropriate revulsion for your own work? And if so, how?
I've learned to ignore it.
Okay.
That's like the coda to overcoming it, is to just don't pay any attention to it.
Yeah. You worked at Microsoft in the mid-80s, and you worked as director of advertising. Has that experience shaped your fiction and influenced your worldview?
That's a good question. Nothing will ever be as stressful again, I hope, as working at Microsoft. I was there for 3 years in its early days when we were working a minimum of 80, 90 hours a week. And 1 week I worked 120 hours, and I added it up at the end of the week. And I thought, well, that's not possible. There aren't 120 hours in the week. But in point of fact, there's 148 hours in the week. You get 28 hours to sleep if you sleep under your desk.
Wow.
It was a really interesting experience. I can't say I enjoyed every moment of it, but it was stimulating, it was exciting, and I'm glad I'm not working there anymore. It's not something I wanted to do any longer than the time I was there. Really, when I'd had enough fun, I left. But I learned a lot doing it. I guess what I learned was you have to ship the product. You have to finish your stories and send them out. And if you don't do that, you're not doing anything. So the fact that it takes me a long time to write my stories, it speeded up after I left Microsoft. I think I spent a couple of years juggling how to do that. But it got faster after I left Microsoft.
Eileen Gunn is the author of Questionable Practices. She was talking with Doug Gordon.
So it was a strange love affair between a prince of mathematics and a little dancer.
Coming up, a new novel explores the relationship between the most fascinating mathematician of the 20th century, Kurt Gödel, and his wife, Adele. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I'm Stephen Byrne, and I am the author or editor of several books about David Foster Wallace, and I'm currently editing a volume of David Foster Wallace's selected letters in collaboration with the Wallace Estate. And the book that I would like to talk about is Infinite Jest, which was published 20 years ago on February the 1st, 1996. Infinite Jest matters because it's a great book on a sentence-by-sentence basis. I would argue that it is not, in fact, a novel, and if you try and read it as a novel, you will misunderstand it. Novels we think of typically having a single linear plot that moves through a sequence of chapters towards a clarifying conclusion. Infinite Jest really isn't like that. It's much more has much more in common with a short story cycle. Infinite Jest should probably be read less in terms of moving towards that single resolution of events and more in terms of a sequence of brilliant short takes on what it means to be alive at the end of the 20th century, what it means to be exposed to a sequence of electronic entertainments that seem to answer many human needs, but in actual fact leave emptiness and particularly soul-level sadness, Wallace seems to suggest. The book is about a multi-track sequence of plots, a sequence of things that happen almost simultaneously. It is about a young man who is moving towards his maturity, who, through a combination of what seems to be depression and drug withdrawal, begins to just question why he's alive, what has happened to his family, and what he is living for. At the same time, there is a 28-year-old convict who is on the run from the law and eventually is recovering from being shot, who is exerting near-heroic efforts to avoid falling back into drug addiction and to take pain-killing drugs, as he's in an incredible amount of physical pain. The book balances between these two plots in particular and explores a sequence of questions that really it's hard to be more specific about than that they explore what it means to be alive. It's an exploration of the depths of human identity, why we do certain things, what we live for, why we make particular choices, why we are not perhaps better than we are in certain ways.
Stephen Byrne recommends Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. The novel celebrates its 20th anniversary on February 1st. You'll find more bookmarks and an interview with Byrne on our website at ttbook.org. One of the greatest scientific minds of the 20th century is on our minds this week, Kurt Gödel. He was a friend of Einstein's, a brilliant scientific and mathematical thinker, famous, among other things, for his incompleteness theorem. Reams of papers have been written about Kurt Gödel, but not much is known about his wife, Adele. A new European bestseller is changing that. It's called The Goddess of Small Victories by the French writer Yannick Granec.
The question is, where is beginning the craziness? I don't know. It was at the edge between the genius and the pathologic.
Mm-hmm.
His real illness was paranoiac.
Mm-hmm. Paranoiac.
And at the end of his life, he stopped completely eating and he died starved, completely anorexic.
Wow. He died of anorexia?
Yeah, he was very afraid to be poisoned, even by his own wife.
Wow.
Yes, we can think it was a little bit crazy.
Mm-hmm. How did Kurt and Adele meet? Because they are a bit of an odd couple. She was a cabaret dancer and he was a math genius. What did they have in common or what drew them together?
The first thing is that they were living in the same street in Vienna, the Lange Gasse. So I suppose the first time they met, it was in the Lange Gasse. For the story, to tell a love story, I decided they met in the cabaret, in a nightclub, sorry, where Adele was dancing.
Mm-hmm.
They have nothing in common. She was from a poor family and she was already divorced and not from the same region and she was older. And he was the son of the bourgeoisie, very famous already in the university. So it was a strange love affair between a prince of mathematics and a little dancer.
Hmm. How much of this is a matter of historical record? How much could you find out about their marriage and how much did you have to imagine?
For all the part about Kurt Gödel, there's a lot of documentation. We have biography.
Mm-hmm.
For Adele, there's almost nothing. Hmm. It's the real work of fiction because I just have to imagine. She was like the unknown in the equation. We know the story of her husband. We know the story of the century. And she was the poor wife, the forgotten wife. And we have to imagine all her life, her fears. That's the job. It's the work of fiction.
Mm-hmm. She didn't leave any papers, diaries, letters behind?
There's some letters we can find. There's few sentences in, for example, the Oscar Morgenstern Memories, which was one of the best friends of Kurt Gödel. His wife said a few things about Adele. They said that she was a little bit rude, but very intelligent and very funny.
Huh.
It's a good base to build a character.
Hmm. So you've got the old woman who's looking back over her life and marriage with Kurt Gödel. And then you've got this young woman, Anna, who comes in and meets the old woman in a nursing home, and then you kind of follow a bit of the two women's stories. But you're saying that gives you, as a novelist, that let you uncover Kurt and Adele's life both from the inside and also from the outside through the eyes of Anna, this observer.
Because the incompleteness theorem said, but it's not mathematics, it's crazy to say it like that, but that a system cannot understand itself by itself. You have to be outside of the system to understand the system. So I try to use this reflection. But of course, the incompleteness theorem is only a mathematical theorem, and it's a scandal to use it like this.
I mean, you're using a mathematical theorem in a metaphorical sense, which probably would make Kurt roll over in his grave.
Oh, I think he will be crazy about this.
Yes. The Gödels lived through some kind of harrowing times, right? They fled Vienna after the rise of the Nazis, and there's a scene in your novel, Adele is kind of fighting off some brown shirts with her umbrella.
It was in 1938, and there was going out from the Mathematics University of Vienna. The brown shirts, the Nazis, young men, were trying to, I don't know how, to her, to be rude with Kurt Gödel, and she saved him with her umbrella. She was this kind of woman.
What did she do? Just sort of stab at them with her umbrella?
Yeah. She was like the Bruce Lee of Vienna. She was an heroine. So I went to Vienna and I went to the mathematical university to see the place, and it was an emotional trip to go to the university, and I went also to Grinzing in the sanatorium where Kurt Gödel was hospitalized.
Treated for depression, right?
Sorry, treated for depression. In this kind of place, it's crazy because time seems to be frozen. You can imagine very easily the 13, and it's the same thing in Princeton. You can imagine the 15, the golden years after war in Princeton, because nothing seems to change. Time is frozen here.
So you can kind of look across the campus and imagine Kurt Gödel and Einstein walking together?
Oh, yeah. And I had my watch to check the time of the length of the promenade they made to be sure that it was a rational idea to make two chapters in the conversation between them. So I'm a little bit crazy sometimes.
You timed the walk that they would have taken to see if they could have said everything you said they would say?
Yeah, because, you know, it was a man about logic and rigueur, very serious and very precise. Precise. So I had to be precise. I cannot make something to him. So it was like a courtesy to make to him.
Oh, that's lovely. It was kind of a caretaker marriage. In a way, she was older than he was, and he was this brilliant genius, bit of a child, I guess. So she really took care of him.
Yeah, she was the nurse, the wife, the nurse, the lovers, but she can never be a mother. And I think it was a big emptiness for her. The first title of the French novel was The Incompleteness of Adele, because her husband has the glory.
The glory.
The glory. She managed to make him survive all his life, but at the end, she was incomplete because I think she wanted to have children. I don't think it's a universal choice for women, of course. I think this woman missed having children. It was a life of solitude and devotion.
You said at the end of his life, he became anorexic. He wouldn't even eat her food?
No, at the end, because at the beginning he was already anorexic, and she was the only person he accepted to be fed by. At the end, he was so paranoid that even the meal and the food prepared by Adele, he didn't want to eat it. In fact, the real poison was himself. He never realized that his brain was poisoning himself. That's the black humor of the thing.
But what a terrible thing for her to feel that she'd devoted her life to caring for him and taking care of him, and then in the end, by rejecting her food. You know, it's a primal rejection.
There are no justice. But there are, I'm sure he was loving her. We can say in the letters some few words about Adele were full of tenderness. He was so selfish, I think. But selfish because of work, because he wanted to touch something so untouchable, to reach the stars, to reach the higher degree of abstraction. So there's no place for the body, no place for love or things like that. So human, so banal. And she has to accept this. I don't want to say that I'm agree with him, but I'm trying to understand each of them. It's not Adele versus Kurt. It's always a strange alchemy in a couple, because I don't think she was a martyr. I think she found a real place and she found a mission. And she was very proud to be the wife of the great man.
So as you set out to imagine Adele and to begin to kind of hear her voice in your head, who did she become to you? What do you think she was like?
She was talking to me at night. I didn't know my grandmothers. So perhaps I saw her like a grandmother's, and she is the meeting of a lot of women I met all my life, strong women, not intellectual women, but the women who are strong enough to survive again and again and to fight for their love, for their children, and who are the forgotten people of the world. But they have a real thing also. We have a part of the knowledge of life. And for me, it was also important than the scientific knowledge.
Yannick Kranek is the author of the novel The Goddess of Small Victories. It's a story about the relationship between Kurt Gödel and his wife Adele. That's it for this hour, but there's more online. And you can hear To the Best of Our Knowledge whenever you want if you sign up for the podcast. Visit our website and we'll tell you how. That's at ttbook.org. Today's show was produced by Doug Gordon. The rest of the team includes Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Charles Monroe Kane. Special thanks to engineer Joe Hartke. Music by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Audio wizardry courtesy of technical director Kirill Owen. Executive producer Steve Paulson. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and till next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.